Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 41, section 4, which is old single column, page 459. Okay, so let's recall what we did. Finally finished that previous section last time. They were giving us some facts about, basically stars on the outside, and we're going to get a little bit of stars on the inside to balance that out. And certainly, the same is going to apply all the way through the end of paper 42, as I've stressed. What we're looking for is not mere disclosure of fact. We're trying our best to have the objectivity and to be open to revelatory suggestion enough that we can begin to pick up on what threads of truth they are touching upon as they're giving us this survey through astronomy and physics. It's very seldom merely about some single data point, fact point. Unless that particular bit of information is very key in and of itself to be able to have a coordinated essential knowledge in order, like we were talking about last time, in order to be able to, for instance, begin to properly calibrate our abilities to determine distances in the cosmos so that we have a more truthful sense of exactly what sort of a domain we exist in. Right now, you'd think that you could get a lot of sort of the basic truth relative to time and space with what we know right now in astronomy. We certainly think the universe is very big, but when you actually start to get into the details, you recognize we don't appreciate its size or its duration at all in many ways. Simple example with the size. If you run with what current science thinks for the size of the Milky Way galaxy, you're going to be cramming the affairs of Orvinton into a much smaller space than it actually functions in. And you won't appreciate the difficulties of managing it, for one thing. You want to appreciate that the size of Orvinton is as big as you can make it and still have it be just manageable. It would be way smaller than that if it was the size that current science thinks it is. If you start with that, impose that false perspective upon the revelation, you're going to get off on a wrong track just to start with. And certainly, if you start with some idea that the universe is some number of billions of years old, somewhere between 13 and 14 billion is their current rationalization scheme, that's extremely false space to start your understanding of your nature and your cosmos and how it's a system, to think of it in such limited temporal terms as that. A billion years may seem like a long time, but it's not. It might as well be 1,000 years if it's only a billion years. You need something much bigger than that in order for the universe to be fundamentally logical. Those are simple examples of how we're trying to to liberate ourselves from the scientific ignorance as much as we can, and yet not throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's plenty to be taken a hold of in evolutionary science. It's just you have to do it objectively. You've got to know the difference between baby and bathwater. You've got to separate it out. You've got to figure out where the truth is, where the falsehood is, and dump the falsehood, and firmly take a hold of the truth, and then bring that true evolutionary, human-developed picture into proper relationship with the divinely revealed picture, and get the whole picture. All right, so let's just keep chugging along and see what kind of issues they're touching on. They're using every excuse you'll see to, especially to suggest. Especially when you get into the science, very hard science sections, there tends to be even a higher ratio of suggestion to actual disclosure because there's so many, stark boundaries in their mandate about what they can tell us. So they're constantly suggesting because they can't directly say. And so you want to look really close at what they're suggesting.
Section 4, sun density. The mass of your sun is slightly greater than the estimate of your physicists, who have reckoned it as about 2 octillion, 2 times 10 to the 27th power, tons. It now exists about halfway between the most dense and the most diffuse of stars, having about 1.5 times the density of water. But your sun is neither a liquid nor a solid. It is gaseous. And this is true, notwithstanding the difficulty of explaining how gaseous matter can attain this and even much greater densities.
Okay, so that last sentence we're going to combine with the next little paragraph. But let's deal with the two little tidbits that they put in there before that. Okay, so they start out... if you just, look up the mass of the sun, you go, sure enough, it's like 2 times 10 to the 27 tons, in that ballpark. So it is indeed about. That's, not even remotely close to the point of what they're saying. The point of what they're saying is for you to go, now wait a minute, what do you mean the mass of your sun is slightly greater than the estimate of your physicists? And especially if you think about the determination of how massive the sun is, how much gravitational, more specifically, how much gravitational influence it has on the Earth, say. I mean, we've been studying that very precisely for a very long time now, in relative terms. That we know that number to many, 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 many significant digits. I mean, if we didn't, we could never get a satellite to another planet. I mean, you'd miss it by a million miles. If we didn't know that gravitational influence very precisely. Now, you could say, if you know the physics of this a little bit, it's like, well, do they mean separating the total gravitational influence from the mass itself? In other words, there's a constant, there's a universal constant, a gravitational constant that you have to divide out of that to get the actual mass. And we don't know that to as many significant digits. I mean, are they just telling me something like that? Are they suggesting I should try harder to get the fifth decimal place on the gravitational constant? That doesn't feel. What are they getting at here? What they're getting at is, remember, they're trying to tell us things that we cannot know. And if we don't know them, there's no way we're ever going to get things properly coordinated. The thing that we can't know is that there are mechanical controllers resident in this domain of space. In particular, they've created the cocoon that shields us from the harsh energies of our immediate stellar environment so that there can be inhabited life here. What do they tell you about those mechanical controllers? They have a very profound anti-gravity presence. Not the kind of linear gravity where, you know, if you could find one of them, you know, there would be this point that would be like pushing things away rather than pulling things toward it like a sun pulls things towards it, you know, in that simple gravitational force sense. By anti-gravity, remember we talked about that way back when we were talking about the power beams. What do we mean by anti-gravity? We mean anti-absolute gravity. We mean they possess super-absolute, technically co-infinite nature that can negate a measure of the absolute gravity of the aisle. And by that absolute gravity, you mean the centering influence that manifests into space through a mass. The bigger the mass, the more that centering influence of the aisle is manifesting into finite space. The reason that the mass of your sun is slightly less than the estimate of your physicists, is because if you took away the anti-gravity presence of those master physical controllers, you know, so that you just had the raw gravitational influence of the sun, you go, whoa, what's going on here? All of a sudden the Earth is being pulled much more than it used to be. Did the mass of the sun just suddenly get greater? No, just that mass is being masked, you know, to a degree, as it were. There's no way we can know that the sun is actually more massive than it is, because we know how much gravitational influence, but that's partly negated by the anti-gravity presence of the mechanical controllers. Okay, so they're giving you that little reminder. You know, you could have figured that out, but they've wanted to make sure that you put two and two together there. So when you go to try to figure out your sun, keep in mind that there's some amount that you don't know that you're going to have to try to deduce indirectly in some way, that the sun has a little bit more mass there than it manifests, you know, at a distance gravitationally. Well, now, one way you might be able to figure this out is, if you send a spacecraft far enough away from the sun, you're eventually going to get outside of that little cocoon of anti-gravity presence of those mechanical controllers. And suddenly that spacecraft is going to feel an acceleration towards the sun more than it should, quote unquote. Right? And we've already started to get that sense with these spacecraft that we've sent way out there. And we try to rationalize this away in very fancy ways. And you always can. You can always rationalize it some other way. It'll all seem rock solid. We've figured out why that's doing that. The revelators are saying, no, the reason that you're saying that is because you're beginning to go outside of the anti-gravity presence. And you're starting to see that influence in the raw, unmodified. Okay, so, see, we could begin to figure this out. Figure out how much more that gravity that appears there is when you get outside of that anti-gravity space, and then add that much mass to the sun. You know, that's not going to change moving around inside of that space where there's anti-gravity. We need exactly the effective, not the non-modified gravity to send a spacecraft to Mars or something. But if we're trying to figure out the internal dynamics of the sun, it'd be nice to know how much its mass is actually inside there. You know, directly knowing it rather than this false indirect deduction that we currently have.
So I'm just curious, a body that's outside of this controlled space,
mm-hmm.
the influence that the solar system has on that body, would it be the same whether or not in a controlled
environment? Yes, right. And see, the reason that that doesn't initially seem proper or logical, rational, is because of our current Newtonian-like idea of gravity. Where you're thinking of it as some mysterious invisible force that's reaching out from some gravitational center out and grabbing a hold of something and pulling it. The product of the mass is divided by the square of the radiance, the square of the radius separating, the distance separating them. Remember, everything's a motion. And you need to think about it transcendent of those sort of spatial, centralized sorts of pictures. Think about it more holistically, and just appreciate that fundamentally the reason that that two things move towards each other gravitationally is because they're inward motions. And see, what you're doing is to think of it kind of just simplistically, you have a field of inward motion around the sun. Don't take that literally, but just, so we can kind of visualize it. You have this field of inward motion. And for the close-in region, there's some outward motion that's negating some of that inward motion. And so the field is less inward. But you go out where it isn't being negated, and then it's just as inward as it would be if Right? So there's a discontinuity, see? As you reach the boundary of the presence of those beings, there's this discontinuity in the gravity of the sun, apparently. Well, I mean, it's going to be out somewhere when you're really getting well beyond the region of space that they need to protect. And since we have, most likely, another inhabited world in our solar system way out there, past Pluto, it's not going to be a very close-in space. It's going to be, so you're going to have to get way out there, significantly beyond, Neptune, Pluto, and stuff, and, before you're going to somehow find us. And that's what we see, Now, you might see some sort of a gradation, and there's signs of that. It doesn't necessarily have to be, all one domain and then a cliff. I mean, maybe there's two domains, one for each of the two worlds. I mean, we don't know what kind of over-control they have to impose. Maybe they have to modify things for that world, and so maybe there's, maybe it tapers off, or maybe it has two steps to it, or, this is the sort of thing we'd need to figure out.
Why are they imposing this over-control? What's the reason for that?
There's a whole bunch of reasons. But the sort of just thinking of it as a cocoon, when they name that cocoon of space Mon Masha, the mother place of man, it's not a womb, in a literal sense like a universe, but it's womb-like. It's this little cocoon of protected space. The main reason, for there to be this shielding like that, is because the sub-electronic energy domain out here in our neck of the woods in the Milky Way galaxy is way too extreme to support life. If they weren't shielding us, you couldn't have an inhabited planet out here.
Oh, really?
They talk about that. They talk about how harsh the energy environment is in this region of Norlaishadek. And it just, if they weren't aggressively clamping that down, it wouldn't be habitable here. But then you also, remember the mechanical controllers are, that presence is a presence of mechanical mind, too. So that makes it a little bit more womb-like. There is a little domain of mind here. And then countless things that we can't even comprehend also, obviously. But I was just suggesting one thing. We don't know how much they have to, for all kinds of reasons, regulate a solar system, where the planets are, where their orbits are. See, they have the ability to modify that, because they have they can modify this anti-gravity presence. So, they could make the Earth closer in or farther away from the sun. They could modify this as they see fit. And I'm sure they will over time. You know, especially if we get way settled in light and life, who knows how they will modify this solar system.
I think you were reading last week about how sometimes they do something to keep the sun alive longer than it would have been.
Right, and when worlds, get settled in light and life, they encircuit the stars, you know, so they cease to be, you know, even the relatively natural, quote-unquote, objects that they are now and become very artificial, eternal objects. And, yeah, see, all these things. And you'll see they touch on that, that issue in passing. Okay, so anyway, that simple little statement of, was there a question somewhere? Oh, okay.
I don't understand what, when you were talking about the spaceships going outside of the domain
mm-hmm.
and the anti-gravity and stuff. So anti-gravity, gravity pulls, right? And then anti-gravity would
negate some of that, yeah. So it doesn't...
So what happens to the spaceship when it gets... that you were talking about?
It will be feeling... it'll have to turn the juice up a little bit because it's going to be harder to escape the sun because suddenly the sun's going to be pulling backward harder on it as if it's trying to get away.
I mean, so the sun's going to be trying to pull it towards it?
Right. And right inside it's pulling less because part of its pull is being negated. Mm-hmm. You get far enough out and that's not being negated anymore. And so now it's going to be pulling fully.
So how do they get away from it?
Full thrust.
Right. The same way you get away from any gravitational object, you have to reach escape velocity. You have to be going fast enough to escape the pull. If you try to blast a rocket off of the Earth and it's at less than the escape velocity, it'll go up and come right back down again. Okay. You know, it goes up in a higher parabola until finally it goes off.
So what did they discover then when that happened? I mean, what do they think?
Well, they don't know what to think. They're just trying to rationalize it, and if you told them, well, the reason for that is the presence of anti-gravity of master physical controllers, wonderful, thank you. But, remember, that's what we're trying to remember. The universe is mind-made and personality-managed. And so the assumption that you can ignore beings or God always breaks down at some point. Okay? Here's an example. You can assume, but you're eventually, if you're trying to get the details, if you don't include the influence of a being, you're not going to get the correct answer. Okay? Just a simple example of that. So that's the great truth that's between the lines of that first sentence. The universe is mind-made and personality-managed. No matter how, quote-unquote, natural it might seem, at some level, it is intimately directed by beings.
And one more question.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't understand the 2 times 10, 27 times. I can't, how much is, 2 octillion. I've never even heard of octillion.
All right. Just keep going up. Million, billion, trillion, quadrillion, quintillion, sextillion, septillion, octillion. Just keep going up until you get to it. Can someone tell me
how many zeros is that?
Can someone tell me how many zeros? 27, perhaps. Yes.
Is that little 27?
I think that's what that little 27 means, yes.
Oh, that's what that means.
Yes, a 2 with 27 zeros.
Yeah. I just had 27 lights go on.
Okay. All right, so then the other thing is, by and large, as they're talking in this section, like you see the title, Sun Density, they're not talking about the details of how the density varies with radial distance from the center of the object. Most of the time, they're just giving you an average density, okay? Like here. You look up the average density of the sun, and you see it's about 1.4. And here, they say it's about 1.5 times the density of water. It's like, okay, yeah, 1.4 is about 1.5. Okay, but you could remember... But the sun is actually a little bit more massive than we think it is. So it's actually a little closer to 1.5 than we think it is. Right? Just a little. Now, that's sort of between the lines there. But they want to give you, well, another reason they want to just put that down is it's a point of reference for thinking about other densities subsequent to this, relative to that, you know, greater and lesser, how many times greater or lesser than the sun.
I have another question.
Yep.
Okay. What's density of water? I mean, I don't understand.
How, right, so the density of water.
Yeah, so how do you?
Put your hand in water, how does it feel?
Yeah. So okay, you know, what?
One and a half times that, that would be thicker. It would be.
But how, you know, what's the I mean, they're about to say it. What's the definition of density?
Weight per unit of volume.
Right, mass per unit volume. Right. Right. So they're and the density, if you know, like if you do it in grams per cubic centimeter, the density of water is 1 gram per cubic centimeter. So if you take a cubic centimeter, you know, of water, just a tiny little cube like that, you know, and weigh it, you'll see it weighs 1 gram. 1 gram for that little cubic centimeter. Yeah, right. I mean, and of course, the density varies with temperature and pressure and all these sorts of things, right? But that, you know, and so, you know, it's because the basic density of water is one in those units, you know, you just kind of use that as a reference point. You know, how many times denser or less dense than water is something. Okay. All right.
Like, I'm a lot denser.
At the head end or the foot end, which is denser? Okay. All right. So now let's read that. Let's read that next paragraph, and then let me tell you what they're trying to remind us about gases and such.
Gaseous, liquid, and solid states are matters of atomic molecular relationships. But density is a relationship of space and mass. Density varies directly with the quantity of mass in space and inversely with the amount of space in mass. The space between the central cores of matter and the particles which whirl around these centers, as well as the space within such material particles.
Okay, so after the first sentence, okay, I mean, you should be going, okay, why would they waste all those words to tell me the definition of density, for Pete's sake? That's not revelation, okay? Grade school kids do that. What are they doing? Okay.
Where you're from.
All right, so now, okay, so start with noticing there's a little bit more words than you were expecting, okay? They didn't just say the mass divided by the volume occupied by the mass or something like that. And as you get into this in the revelation, you discover that you need to be very precise in understanding how they're going to use the words. Now, I just flippantly used the word occupy there. well, that would be actually invalid if you're going to get precise with the revelation. What they're talking about at the end there, notice they say, So after they say the amount of space and mass, and they say the space between the central cores of matter and the particles which whirl around these centers. Okay, let's start with that. So, in other words, they're wanting you to not think of, like, trying to figure out the density of that tabletop. You know, they're zooming you in on a single atom. Okay, and they're wanting you to think about that atom. That atom has a nucleus. Okay, it has a central core, okay, and then it has electrons whirling about that central core, the particles which whirl around these centers, okay. So that atom has a spherical presence. There's a sphere in which all of that is going on. There's a sphere that contains that nucleus and those electrons that whirl about it. So the first step is to understand that there is a certain amount of space contained within that sphere. Okay? The sphere of the atom contains the space between the particles whether it's the nuclear particle or the electron particles. But there's more than that. Okay, and that's when it gets to, you know, transcurrent physics, as well as the space within the material particles, within the nucleus and within the electrons. And, well, okay, I mean, if I'm picturing all these little billiard balls contained within this sphere, I mean, there's some sort of, you know, if I stuck a billiard ball in there, I don't have free empty space there anymore. I got to include that. I'm not going to subtract that out. If I'm going to think about the density of this atom, I would just take the radius of this sphere and multiply it by 4/3 pi, you know, and cube the radius and get 4/3 pi r cubed for the volume, and take the total mass of the nucleus and all the electrons, and, you know, and I get the density. Density divided by that volume. So what's the big deal? I still don't get, you know, why are you wasting all these words on something so trivial as the definition of density? Okay. Remember, by this point, you've gone through the early part of the book, and you know that when they say space, they're not talking about the concept of extension space. They're talking about something that's literal, a stuff. Space is a thing. Okay? And a particle doesn't contain space. One of those, the nucleus or those electrons, like that sphere of the atom, contains space. The particles occupy space. The space is literally part of the particle. A particle is a unit of motion. It's a little measure of individuated motion. And the simplest way for us to think about motion is like a speed, miles per hour, you know, a distance divided by a duration, a space-like fact divided by a time-like fact. What a particle literally is a motion, you can understand that part of what that motion is one of the elements of that motion is space, and another element is time. There's the space that, in part, you know, is the particle, because it's a stuff. Okay? So in order to get the total space, you have to add up all the space that's between the things, which is stuff, not just emptiness, a volume. How much space stuff is between the particles and how much space stuff is inside the particles. Now you have the total amount of space. And you think, well, that actually is different. I mean, it's one thing to think about the volume contained in a sphere, how much extension space. But what about this stuff? To think of density as the amount of one kind of stuff divided by the amount of another kind of stuff. That's a very different idea of density than any scientist has. I mean, right now it's an amount of stuff divided by the amount of not stuff. And you think about that, how could that be real? The amount of something divided by the amount of nothing. It's not going to give you some amount of something. Yeah? It's like saying there can be a relationship between thesis and antithesis. Like there can be a relationship between a something and a not something. No, there's no relationship. It has to be two somethings. This is what they're trying to get you. I mean, the problem we have right now in physics, even at the simplest level of the definition of understanding what density is that we're thinking mathematically, not literally. To begin to think about reality literally, where even the space in this room is a literal stuff, okay? and it's not that abstract mathematical quote-unquote stuff that general relativity talks about, because that's not actual stuff, that's just a mathematical construct, that space-time continuum that they talk about in general relativity. We're not talking about that, we're talking about actual stuff, stuff that exists independent of mathematics, not stuff that only exists because you're trying to take mathematics literally.
Yeah,
and it's not the ether. That's more the force charge of space, of course, you know, when you actually make the ether dynamic instead of static, right? So that's
space.
And
this is a whole new concept.
Right. Yeah. So it starts with that simple fact. The reason that they spent so much time on that is finally get you, oh, yeah, I've got to start thinking literally about space. And so now I have to think literally about density. I'm going to have to rethink everything I think about all this. Like the other part of it, gaseous, liquid, and solid states are matters of atomic molecular relationships. Right now, you go, well, yeah, every scientist knows that. That's not, you know, that's nothing new. Why did you waste all those words again? Well, right now, they think about it, those atomic molecular relationships, as being between billiard balls with forces pulling or pushing on the billiard balls. There is no such thing. Every one of those particles is a motion, not a thing, like a billiard ball, that's sort of a static thing. It's this dynamic, quote unquote, thing. It's a unit of, it's a measure of motion.
Not something in motion. It is something.
It is a motion. It is a motion. And what if you actually understood particles as motions, how would you completely have a whole new understanding of their relationships, as they're saying here? You know, what we currently rationalize as forces. What if you get rid of forces? What if you don't have forces? Because you don't have those static things and the forces between them. What if you have motions and the relationship between motions? Just one second. I mean, you start with the billiard ball model when you're thinking about a gas. And there's a degree to which thinking of a gas as a collection of billiard balls flying around with certain masses and velocities, you know, that's actually pretty literal. But when we zoom in and try to understand liquids and solids, and when we condense this into a liquid or a solid, our theories get very hand-wavy and mysterious. Because we're trying to understand them as a collection of billiard balls butting up against each other with all these mysterious forces that we've endowed them with. And it doesn't come out simply, like it came out simply with the gas. You know, it involves an endless series of epicycle, hand-wavy arguments in order to get the, you know, like a solid-state physics. In order to get a solid-state physics, you have to have all kinds of folderol to try to make those non-existent things give the correct answer. There actually aren't little billiard ball-like objects in close association. This is a system of motions, you know, like the collection of 100 automatons. Isn't 100 little billiard balls crammed into a sphere with some, you know, casing around it? Those are 100 units of motion in some sort of a complex system of motion. Okay. right. So the reason they're, when they say, but your sun is neither a liquid nor a solid, it is gaseous. And this is true, notwithstanding the difficulty of explaining how gaseous matter can attain this and even much greater densities. If you don't want to go down the current path of rationalizing these things, you have to start all over again. We don't understand objectively the difference between a gas, a liquid, and a solid yet. That's how primitive our physics is. We have rationalization schemes that get us some of the answers. Okay, but we need to start all over again. Because step one, technically, even something as simple as density is not exactly what you've always thought it was. When the denominator is a thing and not an absence of things.
Not like we've done it all.
Okay.
Yeah. Motions of what? And then at the same time, I had a question.
Mm-hmm.
I think I know the answer, but what's the medium? What's the motion composed of? I mean, how does that?
Yeah. See, that's what you have to wrestle with. You know, that's the first question: is motion of what? No, it's not the motion of anything. It is a motion. That is the fundamental fact. Not mass. It's not a universe of mass that sometimes, you know, masses that sometimes move. The most fundamental thing is a motion. The most fundamental individuation of physical reality is an ultimaton. You know that from the Revelation. Okay, so just believe that, if nothing else. You know, and then notice, when we get to paper 42, they're going to tell you that most fundamental individuation of physical reality has three properties. All three of them are motions. It's a motion. That's what it is. It's not the motion of anything. It is a motion. And space isn't the absence of something. It's actual stuff. And that stuff goes in, is part, one of the elements of a motion that is a particle. Okay, and so the very movement of a particle is nothing like anyone has ever imagined. You know, we think of them as little billiard balls moving through a vacuum. There is no such fact. You know, it's occupying the space it's in, and then it's going to use the space that it's going to be at next, and then it's going to use the space. I mean, that space that it's moving through, you know, is actually part of it as it's moving.
We talked about that in our
right. We start to get into this a little bit, you know, in Reawakening Philosophy 1, because you have to begin to understand this in order to break the longstanding paradoxes of philosophic history. You can finally resolve those long-standing paradoxes. Once you finally understand what things are and how they move, quote unquote. okay, so that's the point of that, is to just blow the doors off of that whole domain of not only the nature of stuff, but the relation of the stuff to the space. All the inside and the outside has to be totally rethought. It's like, well, what's left? Yeah, nothing's left. You got to start all over again. Everything needs to be rethought.
So everything we learned in sixth grade about solid, liquid, gas, forget it.
Well, you know, you don't want to totally forget it. You want to, I mean, the degree, that's what I was saying early on. You got to know where the baby in the bathwater is.
Right.
Okay? There's some truths of observation that are valid. But the rationalization schemes that are attached to those aren't necessarily valid. I mean, you're seeking valid rationalizations that go with the truths. So, you know, you want to know what we know phenomenologically about gases, liquids, and solids, and then you want to think it anew. You know, you want to know what we currently know phenomenologically about currents, say, but then you want to think it anew. Instead of rationalizing it in the billiard ball model, how do you understand what a current is when everything's a motion? You know, right now, it's little billiard balls moving through a wire, electrons moving through a wire. It's the billiard ball model. That's how we rationalize current. There is no such thing. There are no billiard balls. So what exactly is a current? And maybe if I actually started with a more fundamental assumption, I could not only get the current answers I get, but I could get a whole... solve a whole bunch of mysteries that I currently can't solve. And you will. I mean, you'll completely revolutionize all of physics. Not to mention all of astronomy that we're talking about here right, you know, immediately. Once you start to think these things anew. That whole stellar interior theory that we think we've got all the I's dotted and T's crossed on, you know, we've got to start all over on all that, okay? Because especially when you're dealing with stuff at these extreme degrees, it's not going to behave like we expect from our current billiard ball perspective. It's going to have states of existence that are only understandable when you treat it as a system of motion instead of a system of masses. Yeah. All right. So that's the point of that. And you'll see they're going to just comment along those lines, as I was just saying. You know, what exactly kind of states of matter are we going to have inside of one of these extreme objects called a star?
Cooling stars can be physically gaseous and tremendously dense at the same time. You are not familiar with the solar supergases, but these and other unusual forms of matter explain how even non-solid suns can attain a density equal to iron. about the same as Urantia, and yet be in a highly heated gaseous state and continue to function as suns. The atoms in these dense supergases are exceptionally small. They contain few electrons. Such suns have also largely lost their free ultimatonic stores of energy.
One of the main reasons they threw in that last line is to completely throw you off kilter so that you don't have an easy way to rationalize what they said before that with a current picture. And it's like, yeah, Chris, you were talking about gases, liquids, and solids. You forgot there's a fourth state. There's plasmas, and you know, in the interior of a star, like we all know, is actually a plasma. And you know, and you see, they even mention that you have ionized atoms there. The atoms in these dense supergases are exceptionally small. They contain few electrons. Okay, you ionize, strip some of the electrons off of those, so you have ions instead of neutral atoms, and you're going, yeah, we've figured out all that. Well, they're not allowed to tell you things that you can figure out. So what are they actually telling you? You know, by super gases, they don't just mean high-temperature plasmas, high-pressure, high-temperature plasmas. These and other unusual forms of matter. What they're trying to tell you is we're currently trying to rationalize a star with solid, liquid, gas, plasma, billiard ball states. And they say, no, it's much more complicated. There's all kinds of states that you can't even imagine right now from your billiard ball perspective. When you start to think of it in more objective terms as a system of motion, it has all sorts of states that are very different than anything that is sort of even an extrapolation of your current picture. And so they're just telling you that. They obviously can't give us a lot of details, but they're making sure that we don't limit the space that we try to rationalize in. It's like, I only have four states. I got to rationalize it with those four states. Solid doesn't work, liquid doesn't work, gas doesn't work. Okay, plasma. I got to make it work with plasma. And I just add epicycles until I get the correct answer. Okay, and now I know how the sun works. That's what we're currently doing. But once you know, now it's a much more complicated thing. Patiently begin to try to figure out your physics, and eventually when you know fundamental physics better, you'll be able to totally rethink the interiors of stars. Yeah.
Can science ever arrive at these realities outside of revelation?
No, that's the whole, I mean, everything they're telling here is what we need. I mean, there's no way, you know, anytime soon that we can begin to recognize beyond the current state of physics. Where, remember, they only give you revelation when the evolution peaks out. And Adam and Eve come when the biologic evolution peaks. Okay? That's what revelation is about. So we've gotten as far as we can go with human evolutionary science and philosophy.
And here we are.
Now you need this, you know, to go further, to continue your path upward. And right now, you know, we've been descending for over 100 years. So the first step is to back up to the peak and, you know, and move from the peak. Go back to the beginning of the 20th century before all the current false rationalization schemes were added on. You know, keep the truth, but, you know, think it anew. Yeah.
But however, I mean, I don't think it necessarily means you need a book revelation. I mean, individuals can have revelation. Individual people could, you know, figure this, come up with these ideas, play on it, work with them, etc. It's probably how a lot of people got to where they are today.
Right.
So there's a, you know, over a long period of time, evolution does eventually get to these things, but without revelation, it takes forever, so to speak.
Right. I mean, it's, yeah, theoretically, you can imagine, you know, the slow work of your relationship to the Holy Spirit giving you ahas, you know.
Theoretically.
But, you know, notice even in the normal conditions, an Adam and Eve come to help them with the science. I mean, no amount of evolution produces Adamic children. See, so remember, there is that boundary. There are distinct limits where, I mean, some of the things they're giving us because the slow process, the glacial process, you know, will take too long, and we need to pick it up. Others are just, doesn't matter if you let it go for 100 million years, you're never going to get it without some help. Yep?
It is not magic, but if we have the problem in absolutizing, do we have a chance to think anew? What is it in thinking anew that we should love?
Yeah, I mean, learn to love the question mark. Learn to save your powder of your absolute dimension of personality for what it's meant for. It's not meant for, you know, astronomy and physics. You know, it's meant for God. Don't use it for your ideas about stellar interior theory, you know, to absolutize that theory. You know, have the courage to let go. Let your relationship with knowledge become a fluid relationship instead of this solid relationship. And just let questions stand as long as they're supposed to stand. I mean, that's why we have the false theories we have right now from the 20th century, is because as soon as they recognize that their 19th century theories didn't work, they panicked. You know, they didn't have the patience and the courage to just wait for enough insight to come along, like you're saying, to be able to conceive of better initial assumptions. We got this. Let's cram it in there and make it work. You know, they should have waited for decades patiently, admitting to their fellow citizens that they didn't know how it worked.
Right.
Forget that.
And that maybe their fellow citizens should back off on how much money they give them for a while.
Mm-hmm.
because they're off in la-la land. Right, but you know the ego is not going to, ego-driven individuals is not going to allow, egotism is not going to allow that.
Well, no, it's really funny because last night I was just reading the guys trying to discredit the book, and they said it was based on faulty science. It blows my mind coming here and say that, you know, they say that again, it's the whole thing. They're never
Wait a minute,
beginning.
What now?
The guys, I was just reading, people trying to discredit the Urantia book, and one of the reasons was saying that there's faulty science in the Urantia book.
Right, the science in the Urantia book doesn't agree with current science, therefore the science in the Urantia book is faulty.
Right.
Okay. Who taught us that assumption? Well, technically, Kalagastia taught us that assumption 200,000 years ago. Okay, that our thoughts are innately divine. The standard that you compare things to are our thoughts. You know, and if the book doesn't agree with our thoughts, then the book is false. So, I thought you thought it was a revelation. I mean, think about it. It's not just people who totally don't believe it's a revelation. There's a lot of people that think it's a revelation that say that.
Right.
Yeah.
Lots.
It's like, well, then you don't think it's a revelation. Right? Either it's the authoritative elimination of error,
or it's not.
Or it's not a revelation. There's only two choices. Okay? You know? And again, like I've tried to stress, especially, the things that they're saying are faulty are those are fact finders.
They went into the ultimate
right. They're fact finders. They look for facts, okay, and they find fault, okay? Again, if especially when you fixate on the facts, there's, by definition, every fact you find will be in contrast to the facts, quote-unquote, that we think we've found, because they couldn't tell you a fact if we can figure it out accurately. So if when you're not dealing with ones where they tell you something, it's like, well, no human has any idea of what that fact is, so I can't tell if the Urantia book's, correct or incorrect. Here's a fact. We think we know how big Antares is. And it doesn't agree with the Urantia book. Therefore, the Urantia book has faulty science in it. It's like, no. I mean, the only reason they could tell you that is because every attempt you make to figure out the diameter of Antares will get the incorrect answer. You can't get the correct answer on your own. If we could, then they would be in violation of their mandate to tell us that. they would be in rebellion. That sentence would be a rebellion sentence. And you know it's not. At least I hope you know it's not. You know, that it's not the rebels that wrote this book. Okay. So, I mean, that's, you know, at some point you have to have the courage to recognize that we're ignorant, that we're not innately divine like Caligastia said we were, that we're very ignorant children, children of God, not adults of God, children of God. And you have to let go. What probability, without a planetary, an integrous prince and staff and an Adam and Eve, what degree of probability is that we've figured out fundamental particle physics on our own correctly? How likely is that? Okay, when the only way beings normally know that is in Adam and Eve, come and teach him that. Is that superfluous? You know, if humans can always figure it out correctly on their own, why in the heck would they send Adam and Eve? It's like, well, it's for biologic uplift. But no, it's not just for biologic uplift, right? I mean, that's not technically the revelation part of the second epical revelation. The biologic uplift, you know, the teachings are the revelation, not the DNA. All these issues come into play, and at some point you've got to decide, are you interested in the authoritative elimination error or not? And if you are, then you've got to take a deep breath, because even the most simple thing like density is not at all what you always pictured it.
So the last two sentences there,
yep.
When they're talking about the dense supergases are exceptionally small.
Yeah.
Okay. We're still dealing with the elements that are in the universe, right? So,
yes.
With a few electrons, that would seem to me like a hydrogen, helium, things that have few.
No. They mean atoms were. No, they're ionized. Take sodium, and you've stripped a bunch of the electrons off. That's fundamentally what they're talking about. No matter how big the nucleus is, it has few electrons. If it's hydrogen, it doesn't have its electron. You know, if it's helium, it doesn't have its electrons. You know, you have to get a pretty big one before the electrons are bound tight enough that they haven't been stripped off. And that picture is nothing new. But thinking about that atom and its system of electrons as a system of motion rather than a system of billiard balls, and the particles that are moving around in this dense state as motions in intimate systematic relationship, the extent to which we can't figure out the physics of this solid that my arm is resting on here without all kinds of woo-woo, is the degree to which we're not going to understand this either. And the key there is such suns have also largely lost their free ultimatonic stores of energy. Right? So in the midst of this energy system of what we have used to thinking of as billiard balls, ionized or not, atoms, there is ultimatons, free ultimatons, that are part of that system of motion. They're not tiny little billiard balls rattling around between the big billiard balls of nuclei and electrons. None of these things are billiard balls.
But they're not forming an electron or anything.
They're not in a 100-fold system. You know, they're individual, but they're not going to be rattling around in between in the vacuum between the particles. There is no such thing, right? So they're trying to tell you it's a very complex system where you can get tighter, as it were, if you don't have to have the amount of space that it takes to have an ultimaton. Remember, an ultimaton is made out of space. If you get rid of those free ultimatons, then you don't have to use up some of the space for them. An ultimaton that's not part of a particle, but an ultimaton that's just free by itself. They're a tiny little sphere of motion, and just one, this room is filled with countless gazillions of them, that aren't incorporated into a into a fundamental electronic level particle. Octillions of them, yes. Maybe even non-nillions or decillions. okay. but anyway, so they're just trying to say a few things to get you to appreciate that, you know, even though we think we understand, okay, when they say about the density of Urantia, so in other words, about 5.5 times the density of water, or the density of iron, in other words, almost 8 times the density of water, you know, we think we understand that perfectly, how a star, I mean, we currently think the center of our sun is gaseous, and its density is, like 150 or something times the density of water. You know, 100 times its average density. Okay? So we think about it, you know, we think that it's a gas and a lot denser than those. See, so someone who's reading this, it's like, oh, well, whoever wrote this has no, exactly. I mean, they don't know anything. I mean, iron, really? Like some 3-year-old wrote this, and they, I don't know, iron's kind of heavy. I mean, that's what they think. That's what they're going to hear. They're going to hear some ignorant person who doesn't know science wrote this, and the heaviest thing, densest thing they know is iron. They didn't even think of lead, for Pete's sake. They're so ignorant. That's what these people are going to think. It's like, no, you don't understand. I mean, they're trying to point out that, they're trying to give you a few basic points to start with to understand how the average density of a star could be, and just a normal sort of star, nothing bizarre, just a normal sort of completely gaseous star could have an average density like 8. An average density, let alone however dense it is in the core. And wait till you see how dense it is on this, out in the outer regions. So if it's, its average density is around 1 or 10 or something, I mean, it's really, really dense in the core. This is the point they're trying to get at. You can have something that's just like your sun, only many, many times denser on average, and it's still all gaseous. You don't have to have any solid or liquid. Right. And you don't have to have what you think you have to have now to make that happen. You get it in totally different ways. All right.
A couple
of questions.
We got more
We don't want to answer all questions. Pick one or two. And
the revelation and the mandate. Why do we have that?
The revelation mandate is there because fundamentally we live in the domain of God the Supreme, not God the Father. It's not the domain of Father Fiat. It's the domain of Supreme Evolution. In general, the only facts that are real are those that evolve into existence. And if they don't evolve into existence, they must be very, very precisely transcendently synchronized with that which evolves into existence. In order for a fiat injection into the evolutionary process to not be rebellion, you have to understand what the completed grand universe is like. Even when you're injecting at the very beginning, you have to know the end from the beginning in order to properly do that. Why did Jesus say, my hour is not yet come? Because he knew he didn't have a hold of the big picture enough yet where he could properly insert. If he just took his ignorance and his powers as a creator to insert himself into time, he would have been in rebellion because he wouldn't know what he was doing. He would do it falsely. It doesn't matter if he's God. He's not infinite. He has to get a wide enough perspective. You've got to see the big picture before he can properly insert. You can't just insert any old thing into time and space. So there's very, very tight mandates on revelations so that it's not in defiance of God the Supreme, of evolution, creativity in time. We don't live in Havona, where it was all just put in there, you know, with no process. Yep. One more thing?
Space emotion, is space living?
Space is not a motion, but space moves. Yeah, and then for some of those details, remember, you go back to the earlier papers, and you know, back in part one there, when they talk about those things. All right, okay, so that's basically what they're doing. They're saying it's really a fascinating system, the interior of a star, and once you have better physics, you're going to discover a really amazing thing that's going on in there. And it's going to involve all sorts of states of matter, you know, states of systems of motion that you can't even imagine right now.
All right. He wants to know, is truth emotion?
Ha!
And is it living?
Yeah.
Truth,
you can. Yes, you can think of truth as a motion. Not you know, in the physical sense we're talking about right now, but certainly think of truth dynamically. The reality is, you know, when you say that simple old expression, our God is a living God, and then you combine that with the logical statement that there's a first source and center of all things and beings, that means all things and beings come from that one living God. Therefore, everything and every being in its true nature is like the source, that living God. It's fundamentally dynamic. Everything is a motion. All your thoughts are motions. You know, all the objects are, you know, in the external world are motions. Spirit substance is a motion. Everything is a motion. Your volition is a motion. You know, it's a flow in the Father's personality circuit. Everything, you know, if you generalize the word motion. But right now we're using the word motion very specifically. You know, we're not bringing in mind motion, for instance. We're just talking about the kind of motion that is physical energy. Limiting our picture to that. But technically, it's like that, you know, like at times they focus on just physical energy, but they say, well, you can generalize the word energy. Actually, you know, there's all kinds of other energies, like spirit energy. Okay? Same thing. But, you know, what is an energy? It's a motion, more fundamentally.
I still don't understand the last sentence. Such sense have also largely lost their free ultimate
autonomy. So they're telling you that if things get dense, you squeeze out the normal free automatons that are within. In other words, they're telling you inside of our sun, there's all kinds of free automatons trapped, quote unquote, you know, incorporated into that system. Don't think of them literally as trapped. See, but they're within the system, these free automatons. But you can get to a denser state where there isn't room, quote unquote, for any free automatons. Either the automatons are out, you know, in space now, or they've been incorporated into particles. And if you take 100 automatons that are free, you can combine them into a single electronic level particle base of 100, a collection of 100 automatons. Now those 100 automatons aren't free anymore. They're bound within a system. Right. Right. But natural processes do that. And one day, we will be able to do things like that. You know, one day you'll have advanced ultimatonic level physics and technology. Okay, let's keep going here.
One of your nearby suns, which started life with about the same mass as yours, has now contracted almost to the size of Urantia, having become 40,000 times as dense as your sun. The weight of this hot, cold, gaseous solid is about 1 ton per cubic inch. And still, this sun shines with a faint reddish glow, the senile glimmer of a dying monarch of light.
And just that last line, remember the word senile just means old, technically. In terms of the root, no baggage attached to it. It just means old. But the idea of the suffix there is the word is meant to invoke the properties associated with being old. And it's mostly become just, addled mind is what we think now, that's getting it, pretty limited. It fundamentally doesn't mean that. Okay, so they're just talking about one of the properties of old. Remember we read that where they said, but very young and very old suns usually shine with a reddish glow. One of the properties of a very old sun is a reddish glow. That's senile. See? Okay. That's an aspect of being old. Okay. See if we can stay focused here. Okay, so now notice what they're doing. Now they're going to give us a few tidbits, a few anchor points that down the road you can test a proper theory with, where if you get a star that is quite old, so that it's just this faint reddish glowing object now, it's not purely gaseous. Down its central region, its core region, is a solid now. Okay, look at the hot hyphen cold, gaseous hyphen solid. The root, the foundation words are cold and solid in each case. So that's what's at the core. It's a cold solid at the core. And what's added on top of that? The way these hyphenated constructs work. Hot is added on top of cold, and gaseous is added on top of solid. Okay, so you have a hot, gaseous, stellar-like interior, but now there's a solid, cold core, okay, that's developed in this thing. Now, in this one, they gave you this example, they said it's about, so the average density, with the gas and the solid all, averaged together, the average density is about 1 ton per cubic inch. Now, you remember back previously, in the previous section, they gave you the example where it's about 6,000 pounds per cubic inch. Instead of 2,000 pounds, like this one, per cubic inch. That one, it said, not all stars are solid, but, .. Okay. If it's mostly solid, okay, it's going to be even a higher average density, like 3 tons per cubic inch. Okay. Here, they're giving an example where the average is about a ton. The central, core there is going to be a lot denser than that. That's solid at the core. You basically have as an ultramontanic crystal down at the core there. It's like a giant nucleus, sort of, down at that core, that's solid. But then you have a gaseous star, phenomenon around that. Okay, so that's what's going on there. Now, the thing about this relative to current science, that's very important, is a current scientist reading this, as he starts reading this, he sees 60,000 times as dense as your sun, and he's thinking, oh, okay, so they're noting these really dense objects that we know about, white dwarfs. But then you keep reading, and it says faint reddish glow. It doesn't say intense white glow. It's not a white dwarf. Remember, they dismissed that back in the previous one where they said, actually, you think these things that you call white dwarves are really old, they're actually very young. The collisional dwarves may be very young and may glow with an intense white light, right? because we have everything backwards. The old things are young and the young things are old. Okay, so either you go, well, okay, whoever wrote this is, you know, totally hopeless. They don't even know that white dwarfs are white. You know, and they said red. Or maybe you give the whoever wrote this a little bit more, you know, a little bit more benefit of the doubt. And you say, oh, this person, they seem to be thinking that you can have a star that's so old that it's now just this barely glowing little red cinder heading towards being just what we call a black dwarf, theoretically. And going, well, okay, see, so obvious whoever wrote this wrote it before we knew that the universe is only 13 point, you know, whatever billion years old. And we now know that there are no objects like this in the universe because the universe isn't old enough for there to be one of these old glowing cinders. No, the universe is trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of years old. Plenty old enough for a star, even one that's close by, one of your nearby suns, has been around for trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of years and is now almost down to a dead cinder. Okay? Most of the core is a solid now. Okay? The universe is plenty old for such a phenomenon to happen, and that is reminding you that not every star that's close to us is one of the stars that came out of the Andromeda Nebula. You know, we need something that's been around for trillions and trillions. You know. So that this nearby star is some star from, you know, the other stuff. Remember, there's lots of other stuff that was combined in to make Nebadon. You know, this star is obviously part of that other stuff. The Andromeda Nebula, I mean, you know, our sun is only 6 billion years old. Right, the Andromeda Nebula stuff is not that old. You know, even the earliest ones in it. You know, the Andromeda Nebula is less than a trillion years old from when it started. So, you know, it's not trillions and trillions and trillions of years old. See, so they're all that's between the lines of a statement like that. They're pointing out that, you know, you need to think even in your local space, you've got stuff that's not just Andromeda Nebula. Got really old objects like this. You know, we may, in recent years, actually found this guy, because we're starting to be able to detect the things we call brown dwarves in nearby space. And we think there are these, you know, stars that are barely big enough to be a star, and, you know, or planets that are almost big enough to be a star, you know. But actually, one of those things that we think is some sort of, like, giant planet and never really was a star is actually... when this object, this really, really old star, okay, that has gone from something that was, you know, if it was about the same mass as our sun, you know, well, maybe it's about the same size as our sun, and now it's about the size of our Earth. What's the difference there? I mean, you know, how much bigger in diameter is the sun than the Earth? Does anyone remember? We've said it recently. Yeah. It's about 100, about 109 or something like that. Yeah, So, you know, it's Jupiter's about 10 times bigger than the Earth, and the Sun is about 100 times. So it's just kind of handy rules of thumb. So the Earth, the Jupiter, and the Sun give you the sizes of the subsatellites, satellites, and central objects in, like, JERISM. JERISM's about the size of the Sun. The seven primaries are about the size of Jupiter, and all the subsatellites, like the seven mansion worlds, are about the size of the Earth. Yep.
So can you surmise then that these older suns probably didn't have planets that were with life, because by this time they would have evolved into light and life, and they would have been stabilized?
Yeah, right. So if you've got a star that's, you know, in this state, yeah, you know that there's no inhabited worlds around that, because that star wouldn't be dying. It would be an eternal object if there was inhabited worlds around it. Yeah, so don't waste your time sending a spacecraft there, you know, first. Might want to pick something, you know, that's more likely to have inhabited planets around it. Yeah, exactly. See, those sorts of things. See, all of that, look how the universe starts coming alive. You know, you look out and there's this little thing that they're calling a, you know, a Y-type brown dwarf, and you're thinking, well, that's nothing. That's just some stray, oversized planet. Who cares? You know, maybe this guy. It may be extremely interesting object to study more carefully. You know, instead of thinking that it's, something that's not very massive at all, it's actually as massive as our sun.
I've always completely misread this and just made the assumption, even though it doesn't say it, that it was the same age as our sun.
Yeah. Remember what they said up, like I read it, both very young and very old suns usually shine with a reddish glow. So, you know, they're trying to say, general rule of thumb, you see something that's really red, think either quite young, you know, or quite old. You know, and remember, we don't have that idea. I mean, yes, we think that a protostar is going to be glowing red and stuff, you know, and something that even though the universe isn't old enough for such a thing to exist, some really old thing would be red. Yeah, we basically would say that too. But to say what it says after that, the yellow tinge indicates moderate youth or approaching old age, you know, that starts to, you know, go against our current ideas, like I mentioned when we read that. And then to say, but the brilliant white light signifies robust and extended adult life. Totally, yeah, then we're just totally at odds. See, by the time you get to the end of the sentence, you're going, wait a minute, I don't think they're talking about the way we think about stars. Right, because, you know, all of our ideas about the evolution of stars is based upon a false stellar interior theory. You know, we haven't gone out and explored the interiors of all these stars. We don't have, you know, we haven't even explored the interior of ours.
So Antares, being as big as it is, but being red, may not have.
Right, and then the another reason why it can be red, of course, is if it's very very huge, blown up, in volume, so then it's going to be very thin and tenuous, and it's going to be very cool, way out in those tenuous layers.
So it looks
red. Right. There's all kinds of different ways here. It's very complicated. when they're talking about those colors that I was just talking about, they're talking about what we would call main sequence stars, not giants and supergiants. Okay. All right. Okay. So that's a fun little thing that we've got this really, really old, impossible from current theory star close to us. That's a neat little thing for them to tell us. What else do they tell us here?
Just the thing about the 40 versus 60, so the change to the standardized reference text where it was printed in the originally printed as having become 40,000 times as dense as your sun.
No, I mean, I'm looking at the original. It's 60.
Oh, it's 60.
Yeah.
Mine says 40.
Oh, so Gene must say.
Yeah.
When I read it.
Oh, when you read it, you said, oh, I didn't even, I forgot about that.
So it's 60, not 40?
I totally forgot about that issue. I should have noticed it because you read it. One of the things that's gone on is people doing simple back-of-the-envelope calculations and saying, well, that doesn't, if you take something that's a size of the sun and the same mass as the sun, and you shrink it to the size of the earth, you should get such and so, times the density. If you're thinking simplistically, I mean, how do you know what the interior is? Especially since, are we just taking a gas ball and making it smaller? No, we've got solid at the center and gas around it. I mean, you can't make simple sort of extrapolations like that. You need to take the number as it is. Remember, we pointed out, why did they tell you the volume of Antares? So that you could recognize that it wasn't spherical, that it was flattened by a third, all right? And we're about to get to the follow-up on that in the last paragraph here about, what that tells you. I mean, if the volume is just the cube of the radius, why waste space in the book giving you a number cubed? You know, if they give you the number cubed, there must be some reason. Why have they done that? It's just not, it's not because they don't think you can pull out your calculator and put in a number and hit the cube key on it, right? But people do that, and they go, well, I just found a mistake in the book. And that's just so simple-minded.
So 60 is the number it should be.
Yeah, it's supposed to be having become 60,000 times as dense as your sun.
This book was written in the 80s, so everything...
It started to become random now. I mean, it's just sometimes it's like the original, sometimes it's past. There's so many changes. You know.
I've got 40,000. Yeah, this is a second printing.
I've got Eversa Press at 60.
Right. It's just, that's why I say, I mean, for a number of these things, it's gotten to the point now where it's better to go back to the original, okay, and then figure out if it's a typo or a false tangent that someone has gone chasing down.
Well, that's really bad that they would change it.
Nonetheless, okay.
What?
let's just leave it at that. Okay. Just appreciate that the original said 60. Okay.
Oh boy.
All right.
You didn't get it anyway.
Exactly. That's true, but I don't like things to be changed.
Well, unless there's a typo, and then they ought to be changed. Yeah, okay.
Most of the suns, however, are not so dense. One of your nearer neighbors has a density exactly equal to that of your atmosphere at sea level. If you were in the interior of the sun, you would be unable to discern anything. And temperature permitting, you could penetrate the majority of the suns, which twinkle in the night sky, and notice no more matter than you perceive in the air of your earthly living rooms.
Okay. Now, fortunately for our sakes, since we're all feeling a little bit assaulted here, it didn't say most of the S-O-N's, however, are not so dense. all right, so now again, remember, like I said, in general, it's obvious that they weren't allowed to get into the variation of density with radius in stellar interiors. That's something they couldn't talk about, but they could give you average densities. And so they're still playing in that mode, and so let's try to appreciate this. So when they say that one of your nearer neighbors has a density, and I mean average density, who knows what it is at the core and stuff like that, but the average density exactly equal to that of your atmosphere at sea level. Okay, so what is that relative to this average density of the sun that they gave us to start with as a, you know, kind of our reference point? Remember they said it was kind of in the middle territory. You know, so we're looking at densities that are, you know, some, you know, ratio greater and some ratio, you know, the same ratio smaller with the sun in the middle there somewhere. Okay, the density of the Earth's atmosphere at sea level is about a thousandth that average density of the sun. Okay, so instead of about 1.5, it's about 1.5 times 10⁻³, you know. 1.5 divided by 1,000. It's about 1,000th of that. Almost, you know, very close. Okay, so they're pointing out, so you can have a star that is basically working like your sun. It's not blown up into some gigantic, fluffy, you know, thing. It's basically a normal sort of a star, but the average density is 1,000th that of your sun. Okay. Now, to give you an idea of the ranges involved here, you know, when you look at the sun in the sky, our sun, you're looking at what's called the photosphere. You know, you're looking at a level in the atmosphere of the sun that's dense enough, you know, that it appears to us opaque. You know, all the stuff above that, above that level in the sun, is thinner. Well, how dense is that when it gives that impression of a surface? And we call the photosphere. It's another factor of 1,000 less dense than this. It's about 10 to the minus 6. Okay, at most. I mean, maybe, you know, a fifth of that even. You know, like 2 times 10 to the minus 7. Okay, so obviously, if it wasn't hot, like they're saying here, you know, and temperature permitting, I mean, if I went to the current, you know, the sun, the apparent surface of the sun that I see with my eye, that photosphere, I've got something that's 1,000 times less dense than the air I'm breathing right now. Okay, I'm not even going to notice it's there, right? I mean, if it was room temperature, I mean, it would be a complete vacuum. I mean, I would, you know, I would suffocate instantly, right? I would pass right through that surface, quote unquote, of the sun, as, you know, with much less resistance, 1,000, you know, the resistance that I had, my hand has in trying to move through the air in this room. Okay, and I could penetrate, you know, many, many, many miles down. I mean, you know, thousands of miles down. And I still would, I wouldn't even notice there's anything there. I'd have to go pretty deep before I'd even feel as much resistance in my imaginary craft, you know, with the top down, so I can feel the wind through my hair. I mean, I'd have to go really deep before I'd even feel as much wind as, you know, as I feel driving a convertible on the surface of the earth. It's that thin, okay?
Is that true of the coronal discharge also?
Well, all the stuff in the corona stuff, you know, is even thinner, you know. That's really, really rarefied, yeah.
Because in the pictures, they look like thick liquid.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And it's, right, I mean, and it looks like I could go, you know, if I could poke that thing I see with my eye in the sky, it looks like there's a hard surface there that I could poke like I'm poking the arm of the, no, it's not even as solid as the air in front of me. It's that thin. Okay, so, you know, if the surfaces, you know, of stars are that thin, you know, if it's going to be, you know, if it's 10 to the minus 6 at the surface, if it's going to be 1, you know, on average, it's going to have to get pretty thick in the, you know, in the center. But here they're saying sometimes it doesn't get that thick in the center. Sometimes it stays pretty thin, so that on average, it's 1,000th your average density, you know, the average density of your sun. So you could imagine, you know, practically flying straight through the center of those stars without noticing much of anything.
If it weren't for the heat.
If it wasn't for the heat, yeah.
A little toasty.
Right. But in terms of just the density, so when you think about beings, you know, when they talk about like a solitary messenger, you know, experiencing a bit of quote-unquote drag, you know, due to the mass along the path of their flight, you know, what they're telling you is the run-of-the-mill star is not that big of an issue. There's not that much resistance there. You're going to have to go through a lot of them, millions of them, for it to add up to something that would, you know, reduce the effective flight time. Okay? Now, you know, anything that's got solid, you know, dark gravity body-like, okay, now that's going to be, you know, an issue. And you can imagine they navigate around such things.
You're saying they go right through the sun?
I'm just saying that, you know, they could. Now, we know that in general, they don't purposely fly through the sun. How do we know that? When they launch a transport, when do they launch it? At midnight. Right. So that you're going in the opposite direction, so you don't have to fly through the sun. Right, that's why they launch them at midnight. But I'm just pointing out, notice that, you know, don't think of it like you probably have been. It's like, well, yeah, you definitely want to avoid the sun. That'd be like hitting a brick wall. No, it wouldn't even be like hitting the air in the room here.
That's so weird.
Right?
Right, Chris?
What?
Friday Messenger, we go through the sun so fast, it can't blink.
Well, that's because a gravity messenger is totally transcendent of all the stuff. So.
Solitary.
But a solitary messenger, right. See, and he's not going to feel much of anything, you know, relative to a normal star. You know, and they're just pointing out even you wouldn't, right? You could fly your convertible right into that thing and, you know, and you're waiting for your hair to blow back and nothing's happening. It's like you're in a vacuum, okay?
That's the kind of
person I've always assumed that it was the intense pressure that had something to do with a sun emitting light and heat. But if it's this light, what would cause that gaseous sun to be hot?
We'll get to that later. That's a subsequent section. We'll get to the details of stellar energy generation. But I mean, you notice before you get to those details, they're setting the stage. Like you're just recognizing, okay, I can't think about this as like I've got this thing that this solid charcoal briquette that I've heated up and it's just sitting there glowing. I mean, this is like super rarefied. How is it so intense? Okay. You know, and maybe another thing to bring in here, it seems super rarefied when you think about it in a billiard ball model perspective. To have this density, 10 to the minus 3 on average, say, it's like, wow, those billiard balls are really far apart. I mean, I could put my body in between two of the molecules, and not get hit. But it's not a collection of billiard balls, distributed around in a vacuum. It's one giant sphere of motion. It's solid in motion terms, even if it isn't solid in mass like billiard ball terms. It has a continuousness to it as a system of motion, that we currently don't appreciate. That ball of space, all the space within that's contained within that sphere, a lot of it is involved within the particles, and then in between the particles, there's a dynamic in that space and that force charge that tends to make it a whole system, as if there's no vacuum at all, as if there's no nothing between things. An atom, that's why an atom works so much like a single object rather than a nucleus and a few billiard balls flying around it. It's because that sphere is permeated with an intense energetic phenomenon that's a motion that it has motion even if that motion isn't individuated into particles. It's a system of motion. It's a ball of motion. It's a sphere of motion. And from our limited perspective, certain parts of that sphere of motion are thicker than other parts. But it's a continuous sphere of motion of this fundamental physical phenomenon that we don't currently appreciate, that it's a motion, not things in motion. Okay. Currently, when we think about the gas in this room, we think about how, no matter how fast I move my hand, I get a very definitive resistance. We think about that simply because the molecules are moving so fast, there's no way I can kind of get my hands between them really quick or something, and not feel any resistance. But what if you stopped thinking about it in billiard ball fashion like that? What if you thought about it as a continuum? What if this whole room was a motion? And in some sense, the little nuggets of motion were sort of diffused out, in the room. Now you're thinking a lot more like what that atom is like. Why it is that current physics... sometimes to get the correct answer, they have to think about there's little point things called electrons around that nucleus. Other times, in order to get the correct answer, they have to assume there are no points at all, that it's all just a continuous blur of something or other. In order to get the correct answer. Anyway, we'll get into some of that when we get to paper 42. But see, that's what I'm trying to point out, what's going on. To stop thinking about the sun as some sort of a container filled with billiard balls rattling around at really high velocities. It's a sphere of motion. And it's going to have a crystal-like nature as a system of motion. You know, and so there's going to be form in that we can't even imagine right now. That's what we're trying to get towards, is that sort of just completely changed idea about what, and see, and once we get to the next life, you'll start to experience physical reality more like this. It won't be so static like to you. It'll start to come alive. More, the higher you go, the more things will be motions in your immediate experience, and you'll be a motion in that. You know, and which is the being and which is the thing? It's a whole system of motion. And the things have a purposing called pattern, and the beings have a purposing called personality, but they're all motions, and they're all interwoven amongst themselves in an elaborate system. That's reality.
Do you think we'll get to experience that reality here more and then use it to benefit what we do and think, scientists and other fields?
There's a high degree of probability that when you finally start to have a genuine fundamental physics as a system of motion, you'll be able to understand an analogy, the mind energy, more directly. Start to be able to extrapolate the physics of the physical energy to the mind energy, at least the lower domains, like mechanical mind. You know, you'll begin to be able to think about that physics, even though you won't be able to get your hands on it, you know, as definitive as we can get our hands on physical energy. Because, you know, when I say that symphony moved me, I don't appreciate how literal that is. That my consciousness that's quote-unquote moved is literally a motion. You know, and that thing that I'm calling feeling moved is I've modified the motion state of that system. I haven't set it in motion. It's always in motion. I've just modified the motion. And that difference of motion is what I'm calling feeling moved. To see yourself as a living, dynamic fact. There's nothing static about you.
I would really want to do Tai Chi right now.
Okay. All right, see, the more you appreciate this, the more you can extend it to everything. You got a thought?
You know, one thing that comes up really as a theme over and over again, I mean, clearly there's a pejorative that you have in this assessment of the billiard ball notion of reality, and understandably so, in the same way that we have that kind of pejorative about slavery today, when in fact it was a necessary stage in our evolution.
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't be interpreted that way. Don't interpret when I say billiard ball model as just a pejorative.
Well, I want to clarify that, because I think many people would take it that way.
Yeah, good point.
Immediately make that assumption.
Yeah.
So, but the idea here, if we look at things like the Copernican Revolution or, you know, Galileo's experiments with gravity,
sure,
and trying to break people out of very, very, very simple notions that were wrong, mm-hmm. You know, are we at the point yet of, you know, absolutely needing revelation for everything? Or are there some things here, therefore, that we might actually grasp and have these kinds of epiphanies? Is it going to require something on the order of a Copernican revolution, or is it going to be more like a Darwinian evolution?
Let me just get a little bit of history. I say the billiard ball model because all of the basic physics began with that valid recognition that a number of phenomena are very analogous to the dynamics of watching billiard balls interact on a pool table, on a billiard table. Okay. And there are many things that you don't need anything but that model in order to get the correct answer to 12 decimal places. Okay. The issue with when I speak of the billiard ball model and it starts to sound like a pejorative, is when people have extended that, the validity of that model, be obviously beyond its limits. Not because I've read the Revelation, is it obviously, but it should have been trivially obvious to anyone in the beginning of the 20th century that you can't extrapolate that past these boundaries, you know, that it was a model, and it's not a valid model in that domain. But the reason that they have extended it is they couldn't in 10 minutes, so that no one, you know, noticed that the, you know, emperor didn't have any clothes on, you know, they couldn't in very short order come up with something else to get the correct answer to these new domains that weren't getting the answer with the billiard ball model. So they said, we got to stick with the billiard model. No, the smartest people can't think of any other model. All we've got is the billiard ball model. Let's just make the billiard balls magical. And then let's get the answer. Let's apply the billiard ball model where it's obvious logically that it shouldn't be applied. But let's apply it there anyway, make the billiard balls magical, and get the correct answer. Well, that only lasted for a little while, where they knew that they were pushing the model beyond its logical limits. You know, you go a generation or two, and those young kids have forgotten that it's not, you know, that you can't do that logically. And now that, you know, you teach this false application of the billiard ball model as truth, that there actually is magic, i.e., there isn't logic. See, rather than holding on to logic, and maybe temporarily using a false model, you finally just gave up and said, oh, I mean, now that I think about it, why would I believe in logic in the first place? I mean, the fact that I can assume magic and get the correct answer proves that magic exists. And logic was always just a delusion of an immature mind. So we're in that mode now. I mean, so, you know, when I speak kind of dripping with sarcasm about the billiard ball model, you know, it's when, I mean, anyone back in the beginning of the 20th century that had any logical integrity knew that that was, you couldn't assume that. That was illogical. But now they do, and they do it without batting an eye.
What's the definition of magic?
That's where you, it's the opposite of logical. It's where you make assumptions that are illogical. Like the assumption that an object can be in two places at the same time. You know? A circumscribed object can be in two places at the same time. That's illogical. Or the assumption that a cup of water is also a banana. That's illogical. No, it's either a banana or a cup of water. It can't be both. Oh, yes, it can if you throw out that false belief in logic. It can be anything your imagination can imagine. You can imagine a cup that's also a banana. You could write a whole story about it. Fundamentally, when I say magic, you know, in physics, I'm talking about a violation of the law of identity. You know, that, you know, a cup is also a banana. That's a violation of the law of identity. A violation of law of causality, another very fundamental one, that there can be effects without causes. You know, that something can occur, but nothing caused it. That's now valid. Or the violation of the law of locality. You know, the two things can be in the same place at the same time, or one thing can be in two places at the same time. No, that's illogical. all right. Okay, yeah, we're going to have just about the right amount of time. We're just going to do the one section. Okay. Let's see here. So make sure we didn't, we got so far afield there. Okay, right, so they're bringing up that issue, right? It's about a thousandth the density on average. Is there something else?
By magic, do you mean quantum mechanics?
Yeah, in the three fundamental assumptions of quantum mechanics are those three fundamental assumptions of magic that I just, yeah. Violation of the law of causality, violation of the law of identity, violation of the law of locality. But so are other, I mean, just about every other 20th century fundamental theory. General relativity, you know, black holes, all those, I mean, all those things are magical.
What happened to science?
Good question.
Yeah.
It's asleep.
Science is asleep. Technology is awake. You know, rationalization, you know, all you need is rationalization to have technology, but we don't have science anymore. And so that's why we haven't made any new discoveries, because it's impossible when you're working with false assumptions. All right. Okay, so anyway, okay, so back to here. All right, so we're talking about, so they give us an example of a star, one of our near neighbors, whose average density is about a thousandth that of the sun. So in other words, it's about, you know, almost exactly the same as the density of the air in this room. And then like we were saying, just to appreciate that you may be able to practically go right through the center of some stars and not notice your air being blown back. So stars can be very low density, even way down to the core. Okay? All right, now what else here?
The massive sun of Valentia, one of the largest in Orvieton, has a density only 1/1000th that of Urantia's atmosphere. Were it in composition similar to your atmosphere and not superheated, it would be such a vacuum that human beings would speedily suffocate if they were in or on it.
Okay, so now this is a fascinating little one. Okay, so now they're talking about one of these giant stars, like you were mentioning earlier. So if you take a star and it's blown up,
you were saying you'd suffocate.
All right, it's puffed up really big. Now notice the average density is about 10^-6. The kind of density that's just in the, you know, outer reaches of our sun, like the photosphere. Okay, the average density. So, I mean, imagine how tenuous the core has to be. I mean, it might be really dense, but it's got to be pretty darn small. or maybe it's just because the outer layers are puffed up really big. I mean, you know, we got to think about it. But they're pointing out that it, you know, on an average, it's really thin. Now, most likely, it has such a low density, mostly because it's just puffed up really, really, really large in volume. Okay, and it might still be reasonably dense way down at the center of it. You know, we can't necessarily assume that, especially if it actually is a star. And, you know, there's going to be limits. I mean, it's not like you can look at one of those clouds of gas and dust, you know, that are floating out in space like the Orion Nebula, you know, and see it doing the star thing.
Do we know
it's too diffused. Okay, I was going to get to that. Okay, so I was just starting with those basic things, that they're just giving you an example that it can go to an average density all the way to 10^-6. One of the reasons they're doing that, remember they said the sun is about in the middle? So you can have this range from like 10^6 to 10^-6, and with the sun in about in the middle, see? So they're just kind of giving you that spectrum. Okay. Then the fascinating thing is they coined a proper name for a star. Very fascinating. Why would they coin, a name, you know, in English, you know, so that it has, you know, Indo-European roots to it and suffixes and whatnot? Okay, what is the point of that? Well, this would be a really, I got to try to do this sometime. I got to try to figure out the etymology of this coinage here sometime. Because, I mean, my assumption would be, if I can figure out the, if you can figure out the etymology, you can probably figure out what star it is. The name literally probably is a clue, a hint to what star it is that we would observe. That's most likely what's going on there. I mean, there could be other options, but that's the first thing that pops into my head, is that might be a clue. And see, we would know that that star has a very, very low average density like this. We could use that, see, as an anchor point, okay? One of the things that's in play here is we currently think we've discovered a number of really, really giant stars in the galaxy. And we think that they have huge masses, much bigger than 30 solar masses. And the relatives are trying to, no, there is no such thing, okay? For example, I bet if we figured out what star they've coined the name Valentia for, yeah, we think it has some super high mass and whatnot, and it really doesn't have much of a mass at all. It's extremely low density. So it would help to refute false tracks. That's my first. I mean, there's undoubtedly all kinds of things that I can't even imagine yet about what's going on between the lines of their statements. But that would be a first thing I would like to pursue. Figure out the literal meaning and see if it sounds like it's a clue as
it's
to.
It's not a star that we've named.
It's not a star. You can't look up in an astronomy textbook, the star.
Valentia?
Antares? Yes. Valentia? No.
Now there's more and more missing mass in the
universe.
Right. Is there a way for us to figure out the density of a star that's like this?
Well, see, the way this would work is if you have a proper stellar interior theory and you have an average density, that would give you, there would be variables, knobs that you could turn in the internal structure. It's like, well, maybe it's like this. Oh, then I don't get the correct average density. So that's not it. Well, how about like this? I mean, so giving you an average density gives you, an anchor point where you've got to somehow have it denser at the core and less dense at the surface so that on average it's whatever average density. And if you make the core too dense, then you're going to get too high of an average density. Or if you make the outer layers too thin, then you're going to get too low in average density or whatever. See, those sorts of checks and balances on it. We do that with trying to, we've rationalized the interior of our sun, and we know that we've done it improperly if we don't get the proper average density for the sun. And we turn knobs until we get the proper average density. Because the only thing we can measure is the average density, basically. And a little bit of the surface density stuff. But, we have no idea what the interior is like.
So we have a way to measure density.
Well, we have a way of, by spectroscopic observations, of the atmosphere, we can, get ideas of temperature and density and pressure and stuff. Mm-hmm. But then, once you go beyond the point of direct sight, in interior to the photosphere, we're just guessing. Okay. In general, I won't go into detail. We have some things now that give us some information about the interior, but still, it's pretty vague. Yep.
Wouldn't it be fun if someone in this class did some research, did some homework, and figured out what the meaning of the word meant and emailed it to you?
Yeah,
Wouldn't that be fun?
I haven't tried. I tried one time for a little while. I had a few hours in one afternoon, and I putzed around a little bit, and I couldn't get anywhere.
It's so hard.
It's very hard because there's you start digging, and you'll find there's, I could rationalize it this way. VEL in Hungarian is that, but VEL in Romanian is that. You discover there's all kinds of different ways you could rationalize it. The trick is finding the true rationalization, the true etymology, not just any old rationalization of it. That's the tricky part.
How do you know when you hit on that?
It's not easy. Especially when you're dealing with something like this, it's like, what are they trying to suggest? It might be a matter of, well, maybe is it this? Oh, that implies that star. Ah, that must be it. You know, I mean, it may take something like that where you can match up the rationalization with some observation. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can rationalize veranda deck 5 different ways, but when I rationalize it as very father-like expressions, ding, 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 it's pretty obvious that's the correct one. Right, so, I mean, some, you know, the ones that I've figured out, you know, tend to have it's much easier to, you know, to pick through the false ones, because you know something really definitive. A lot of the others, lots and lots of coinages in here that are very obtuse. It's hard to know how to approach them.
Yep. Matt's already having fun with it. He said, just a quick Google, Vela could mean sail or veil.
Yep, exactly.
Yuan can mean in. Yeah, it's fun. And then you just go through and then you check the various languages and different points of view. And then...
And you got to remember that it's... You know, it needs to be an English word, so it's as if it evolved. So, you know, it's most likely going to be Northern European or Latin, maybe a little Greek thrown in. If they're getting a little fancy, they may throw in, that's Indo-European, they may use some Sanskrit if that's appropriate. You know, they may vary the source point in the Indo-European, but it's going to be basically, you know, it's got to be Andite and as if it evolved into an English word. Okay. So, because remember, they're coining an English word. They're not coining a Swahili word. Okay. They're writing this in English. So it's got to be as if that word evolved naturally when they coin it. Okay, we're running over time here already. Let's keep going here.
Another of the Orvantan giants now has a surface temperature of a trifle under 3,000 degrees. Its diameter is over 300 million miles, ample room to accommodate your sun and the present orbit of the Earth. And yet, for all this enormous size, over 40 million times that of your sun, its mass is only about 30 times greater. These enormous suns have an extending fringe that reaches almost from one to the other.
Right, so that let me just do that last line first. You know, we were talking a little bit about how far do you have to go out to kind of get out of the domain of the sun or the dark or the master physical controllers. You know, they're pointing out you get these really big stars and they're, you know, we call it the heliosphere, you know, for our sun, you know, but this region of space that is significantly influenced by the star, especially if the stars are getting closer together, say, towards the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and they're really big, I mean, you know, these extending fridges are going to start almost overlap, and so that, you know, it's not going to be a ball of motion here and a ball of motion here. It starts to turn into, like, the whole region of the galaxy is a motion. You know, with no sort of free space at all, you know, in between things. That's what they're getting at, okay? Okay, now the factual details. Let's do the middle part first. Okay, its diameter is over 300 million miles, ample room for the orbit of the Earth. Even the orbit of Mars will just fit inside of that, okay? It's just a little bit bigger than the diameter of the orbit of Mars. To give you an idea of how big a object we're talking about here. Okay, notice what they did there. They threw in the volume again. They cubed for us again. So you go, well, I better check. You know, this is about... 350 times the diameter of the sun compared to Antares, they said, was 450. This is about 350. Take 350 cubed. Oh, I get just a little over 40 million. Oh, So they're helping me to understand here that you can get something that's all the way up at the mass limit of 30 solar masses. Okay, and it can be puffed out really big. And it still can be very, very spherical. Okay, so that's an important data point, that you can have a very big star, both in mass and volume, and it's almost exactly spherical. You know, like our sun is quite spherical. Okay. So you go, okay, now I'm rethinking what they said about Antares. The fact that they told me that Antares is, you know, has a flattening of 1/3. You know, that its polar diameter is 2/3 of its equatorial diameter. That's got to be an object that's rotating at a very high rate. A rate would indicate that it's not a normal situation, that even a really massive star can collapse down and still be rotating so that it's spherical. This has got to be some sort of an exceptional object. Again, like we were saying back there, it makes it all the more suspicious that that's the residual core of the Andromeda Nebula. Right? That gas that didn't form into stars that were flung off, is that residual core of gas collapsed down. And by the time it collapses down to stellar size, I mean, it is rotating at an extreme rate because it's collapsing down from a galaxy-sized phenomenon to a star-sized phenomenon. Yeah, it's rotating so fast that it's flattening, but it has a flattening of 1/3. Okay, so the fact that Antares is not that far from the ecliptic, the fact that it's that flattened, right, it all suggests, you know, very, very suspiciously that, you know, it is actually that residual core of the Andromeda Nebula.
So if they do reach from one to the other almost. Mm-hmm. Said this a minute ago, is there any room for any planets?
Well,
doesn't seem like it would be.
You know, in terms of if you put this star out here, Earth and Mars, as we're saying, going around, I mean, would they even notice there's a star there?
It'd be hot.
Right, so you know, you could theoretically have things, you know, at least for a while until, you know, drag, you know, brought them down. But, you know, imagine that you could have things orbiting within such low density. So, you know, I mean, remember what they're talking about? They kind of extend. I mean, we're right now the Earth is going around through part of the sun's atmosphere. You know, the extended solar wind atmosphere of the sun, we're bathed in it, going around and around in it, okay? So, you know, that fringe is, a lot of the fringe is like the fringe that we're in right now. But I was pointing out, even if you go down deeper, you can imagine if a star puffs up like this, you know, you could still have planets going around, and it's not like they would immediately, you know, as a star, you know, they suddenly slam into this wall. I mean, it's extremely low density stuff, and so you could, you know, they could be swirling around in that for a long time before they, you know, got incorporated into the object, you know, spiraled in.
We need lots of sunblock.
But now, in terms of inhabited planets, I mean, obviously you're not going to put in creatures on a world that's inside of a star. But
why not? Think out of the box,
yeah. But
and into the star.
But the variation of how much stars can vary in size and whatnot and still have inhabited worlds, I mean, you know, who knows? I mean, they tell you that there's variations of types of inhabited mortal creatures that are even beyond what they describe in here. So, you know, your first assumption is that there's inhabited planets around every star in the sky. That's your initial assumption. And then you start to see if you can eliminate one. Like we think we may have eliminated one nearby one that obviously is should have been encircuited in the eternal, and it's dying instead. So it probably doesn't have an inhabited planet on it. But everything else, you know, Sirius, you know, Betelgeuse, you know, you name it. I mean, you know, they all could have planets, inhabited worlds. You know, it just the physics of what would prevent them is beyond our knowledge. So, yeah.
Oh, you talked earlier. We talked earlier about how we have the physical controllers modulating, you know, the
modifying, yeah.
Modifying them. Mm-hmm. And do all stars that have? Do they all have that to some extent to help planets?
Well, I mean, even if they don't. Even if you don't have inhabited planets where you have master physical controllers that have set up residence, you know, in the solar system, like they said, you know, earlier in the section in the paper here, stars in general are being used in the energy grid. They're leveraging off of them. Okay, so you know, they're pointing out that, you know, even when you look at a star in the sky that has no inhabited planets around it, don't expect everything to be natural about that object. I mean, they're playing with even uninhabited ones to some degree. It may be at a level that we wouldn't pick up, okay? But at some level, if you studied that star, you would notice how it's been modified by the energy grid leveraging off of it, right? There would be some impact. But it may be way down, you know, in the decimal places. But from this initial crude perspective that we can have on it. All right, let's see. All right, we've gone way over. Let's just wrap it up there. So next time, then, like I said, we're sort of moving out in. We got a little bit about, you know, the internal stuff with the density and a few things here. The thing that we're going to get into next time. I just mentioned that very first statement they made. Another of the Orvieton giants now has a surface temperature of a trifle under 3,000 degrees. We'll get into issues like that temperature in Fahrenheit, 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and how it relates to stars as we get, you know, forward a little bit. But the key thing there is surface temperature. Okay, we're gonna need to talk about that going forward. What the revelators mean by surface, the more you reflect on it, you come to recognize is not what we mean when we say, like, you mean like the photosphere? That visible radiation surface? No. There's the issues that are going to come into play. And this is the first time that they've done this, where they've used this term surface temperature, whereas an astronomer might say effective temperature or something like this. Or the temperature at a certain radial distance from the center or whatever. But to call something a surface, we need to figure out what the revelators are talking about. And we shouldn't be surprised if a star can have a surface in a way that we can't imagine in the billiard ball model that a star can have a surface.
Like what?
That there may, you know, when I talked about that sphere of motion, maybe there really is kind of a surface, and inside that it really is a sphere of motion. Then outside of that, maybe it's more like billiard balls dancing around that. Maybe it's more like a nucleus and electrons, an electron cloud around that, where the electrons are like billiard balls, but the center is more like a single object. Right? Right? That's one of the things that they're trying to get us to appreciate, you know, that when you think about it in the genuine terms, and if it's just billiard balls flying around, it's like, well, you know, it's arbitrary where if I stick a line here and say this is a surface. But what if it's not so arbitrary? Right? all right, so that's we'll see that as we get forward, because they're going to go deeper and deeper in interior issues and talking about what's going on inside of a star and how different it is from what we currently think. All right, let's take a moment here.